Hello again, and welcome to the Global Exchange, part of the CJAI Podcast Network. I'm your host and Vice President of the Canadian Global Affairs Institute, Colin Robertson. On this episode, we are rebroadcasting a segment from our third annual Canada State of Trade Conference, which took place on March 10, 2020 at the Rideau Club in Ottawa. This is the Selling Our Agri-Food, How Do We Do Better panel, which was moderated by Mark Agnew and featured a discussion with Claire Cito, Fawn Jackson, and Ted Bilieu.
All right. Well, good afternoon, everyone. Thanks for sticking around for the agriculture panel. My name is Mark Agnew with the Canadian Chamber of Commerce. So we've had a chance to talk about manufacturing. We've had a chance to talk about services. I represent both of those sectors in my membership. I love those folks, but we also have agriculture. And so we're going to pivot gears. And I think agriculture, when it comes to international trade, is genuinely different, both in terms of the barriers that agriculture companies face. I think they're probably much more acute in some respects, and also definitely much more politically sensitive, as we know from the debate here in Canada. So with us here today, we have Claire Cito from the Canadian Agri-Food Trade Alliance, Fawn Jackson from the Cattlemen's Association, and then Ted Bilieu, who is, I guess, running your own consultancy shop, if I'm not mistaken. So I think I'm not going to start anything about the bios because they're all in your book, but why don't we just kind of jump right into it and sort of start the panel with what is it one thing we're getting right when it comes to selling agri-food products abroad, and what is one thing we're getting wrong? Claire, why don't we start with you?
Thank you. Well, perhaps by way of background, just a couple of words about CAFTA. And first, it's a pleasure to be here among people who are very interested in trade and advancing our trade agenda, and in particular agri-food. In these times, it's really important that we continue to work together. CAFTA is a Canadian Agri-Food Trade Alliance, essentially the voice of Canadian agri-food exporters. We represent more or less all of the entire ag sector but the supply and managed commodities. So that's essentially all the beef, pork, wheat, oilseeds, pulse, malt, sugar, processed foods, and I'm sure I'm forgetting some, but a very large and diverse group, and one that is united when it comes to the need for trade. It's roughly about 1 million jobs across the country and close to $60 billion in exports annually. What's working well on the ag trade front? I think we have, we're blessed with resources, with land, with people, innovation, passion, tools, technology. We've got major food hubs, Toronto, Montreal, Vancouver, amongst North America. We've got our largest trading partners south of the border, out on the Atlantic side, access to the huge European market. On the Pacific side, access to fast and growing Asian markets as well. So a lot of potential, a lot of good things. We have in our hands, I think, what is an engine for growth. And this is what our sectors, why our sectors was designed and identified in the Barton Report as one that could really grow exports to $75 billion by 2025, and what that could deliver and contribute further to the growth of the Canadian economy. So a lot of potential, but unfortunately, because we are such a small population of about 35 million people, we cannot eat everything we produce. So we are inherently trade dependent, and we need to export our products overseas, essentially to find customers. And while I tend to be an optimist, this is where my remarks will start to be gloomy.
Be provocative.
I think I'm worried that we take all of this for granted. We take all of our resources and the access that we have and the diversification efforts that our governments and negotiators have worked on. I think we are truly in a new world where we should not take trade for granted, and the NAFTA renegotiation should be a wake-up call. The loss of functionality of the WTO's appellate body last December should be a second wake-up call. Foreign governments have been introducing a number of non-tariff measures. This in addition to the global trade rules being undermined. So we live today in a world of really a lot of unpredictability. Today our farmers wake up and they look at the weather, but they also check the news, because the weather and geopolitics really are what matters to them. And that's unfortunate. So there needs to be a lot of efforts by our governments and a lot of work done here at home, but with our trading partners globally, with international setting agencies, making sure that there is adherence to commitments and to the rules and science-based decision-making overall.
Perfect. Well, I suppose first, before I answer that question, I just want to make a couple comments on Canadian agriculture. And I feel like we have this secret in Canadian agriculture about just what a big economic power we can be. And I have a hard time communicating that sometimes. And this is the fact that I think usually sticks with people when I'm talking about it. You know, instead of telling them about the growth that's happening in Asia and the people entering the middle class, you know, the big thing is we have jobs for your kids, like a lot of jobs for your kids. And I don't, like, whether they're 20 or whether they're 6, you know, the Canadian agriculture is really ready to explode. And so where can we take that as Canada? You know, right now there's around 60,000 jobs open in Canadian agriculture. In the next 10 years, it's expected to double. And I think, so if you had dreams, you know, of a kid of being a cowboy, like, now is your time, you know? And it's not just farm workers that we're looking for. We're looking for engineers. We're looking for, you know, tech. We're looking for HR managers. You know, agriculture has so much excitement. And you know, I'm not oblivious to that's not how it always was. You know, I remember when I was getting into agriculture and applying for school, Yahoo put out this article and it was like the most worthless university degree to get. And I was like, agriculture. I'm like, sign me up. Yeah. You know, but you know, we're not in the early 2000s anymore. You know, we've moved past BSE, which was so fundamentally damaging for the Canadian beef industry. And what we came out with on the other side of that was an industry that is agile, able to survive black swan events, that is so dedicated to their work that they're going to succeed in the long run. And, you know, when I think about the last 10 years of trade agreements, when, you know, we're celebrating the fifth year of the Canada-Korea Free Trade Agreement. You know, you look at CETA, you look at CPTPP, where we increased our exports last year by 20% in the beef industry. You know, there's so much to be excited about. And so perhaps to sort of wrap it into what are we doing wrong? And, you know, one of the things that we did do very wrong, and it's not something that we need to engage on the international front so much, is we got labor wrong in Canada, completely wrong. We do not have enough workers working in rural areas, working in agriculture, and we can fix that. You know, I think that's when I'm out on the Hill talking about the opportunity, I say we can work on this now. This isn't a trade agreement that we need to work, you know, with international partners. Perhaps takes longer time. This is something now that we can work on. And what did we get right? You know, certainly the strategy behind the trade agreements over the last number of years has been fundamental to the opportunity that's in front of us today. So I would say that's a key to what we got right.
Great, thanks. Ted?
Well, it's hard to follow that act. Both of them have done a wonderful job of describing ag today, I think, in Canada. I'd only add a couple of points. One is that we've had to learn how to deal with something less than scale, because we've got a neighbor beside us who is extremely good at scale. So where you see the bright spots in Canadian ag is where we have broken scale and showed we can be very competitive doing so. That takes some thinking, but it usually has to do with the fact that Canadians, and I'll use the example of Americans, Canadians are far better expats. They're far better at understanding the customer abroad because they've had to. Americans never had to. They actually lived well within their own market, and they've discovered export in many areas of ag recently, certainly since I started my career back in the 70s when they were deficit on pork, and today they still barely export as much beef as they import. So, you know, for them, it's international trade's an add-on. For Canadians, it's an absolute necessity. So we've learned how to play those niches and listen to customers and essentially develop products for them. And we could give you some examples. But for time. The other thing I think that we are picking up and grasping for the first time is that we are uniquely sustainable. And this is a world where agriculture is not sustainable and becoming unsustainable quite quickly in many parts of the world. But we have that ability. And, you know, we've got reasonably good soils, and we have rain, which is something that a lot of the world doesn't. So we have a water source. We don't depend on groundwater sources that are depleting. So this is an area that can actually be expanded and yet still sustainable. That's a pretty important factor going into this new world. If I think about, you know, what the kind of the downside here, what the issues are on the downside, I listened particularly interesting to the panel today with Manley and John Weeks, and I was fascinated by the fact that there's a concern here around the strategy. And so I for those of you who haven't read it, you're going to ask about a book. Go back and read a book that was written a long time ago by Harold Innes, The Fur Trade in Canada. I think he described the problem we have today. He described it very well in the 1930s and 40s. You know, it's the reality is we, you know, as I think Colin, you mentioned early in the morning, we've always had, first we sold our resources to the UK, and we were under the protectorate of Britain, and then US stepped in and they became our big resource taker. We've always had that kind of a relationship. Well, that's a colonial relationship. And we are just in the process of trying to, how do you break out of that? Where that really hits us in ag, I think, is in the processed product side. So we have in total processed food products, we have a $2 billion balance of trade positive. But would you look at the further processed part of that, we have a $7 billion deficit. And that's and yet we have one of the strongest brands, as was said earlier in the day by someone else, and yet we can't use that brand because that's the further processed stuff. We can kind of halo use it for some of our ag products, and we do. We do use it well, but that doesn't speak to consumers. They don't know what they're buying unless it's got a package around it. And we have a really big issue when it comes to how to deal with that. And the only way you can deal with that is prioritize processing, you know, over the raw material in your spend. So I think I'll stop there.
Thanks. So we've already touched a little bit on trade agreements, and I feel like in the Ottawa bubble, we almost sort of trip over ourselves talking about, you know, we have trade agreements with all the other G7 countries, the only country to have that luxury. But the experience hasn't been great across the board. I mean, Stephen had a presentation this morning that showed actually in summer sectors we've been doing quite well, but actually in agriculture the experience has been a bit mixed. We're not really actually meeting the full potential. So, I mean, maybe Fawn, to start with you, I'd be curious if you could talk a little bit about the cattle sector's experience with FTAs and kind of your viewpoint on where it is that we need to up our game to actually use them to the fullest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I suppose, you know, going back to how trade has been going for us, and it's been going well. And I think that it's been going well because for us, it's about selling the certain cut of meat into the market that's most willing to pay for it. And so having the diverse set of markets has been so key. So for example, into Europe, whereas they're selling us more beef than we're actually selling them, but we're selling them beef that's $13 per kilo, and they're selling us beef that's $5 per kilo. And then we're also selling into China, that's become a high value market, into the US, into Mexico, into Japan was certainly our crown jewel over the last year, with the tariff rate dropping ahead of the US. So trade agreements have been so fundamental to our success, and they're going to continue to be so fundamental to our success. You know, we're really pushing on the UK negotiation, like let's be there and let's have those conversations so that we can make it as progressive as possible. We were in December and in January, we were number one and number two on the lobby registry talking about the importance of the new NAFTA, you know, saying how fundamental it is to Canadian farmers and ranchers. Where can we make improvements? Well, I certainly think that the last number of years was about the big trade agreements, And I think that the next years are going to be about technical barriers, and that we need to make sure that we are just as prepared and just as strategic to you know, come out of that as a winner than to fall behind. Because quite frankly, you can fall behind very quickly. So, you know, the Canada-Korea Free Trade Agreement, well, we're 8% behind the U.S. in our tariff rate. And it's causing us some big problems right now in our sector. If you look at what the U.S. negotiated with China, say what you will about that, you know, they got access for cattle over 30 months of age, which we don't have access. And so those are some fundamentals that I think are going to put us at a competitive disadvantage if we don't be just as strategic as we were on getting the trade agreements in the first place.
So, Claire, I know we've had lots of conversations in various government forums that we've participated in about PAFTA membership's experience with trade agreements. So I wonder if you could say a bit about, because you have both the meat sector, which includes the cattle folks that Vaughan represents, but you also have the crop side as well. So I'm going to say a little bit about the viewpoint from CAFTA.
So I think what's important to know about free trade agreements, and there's been a lot of talks in recent years about the CETA, CPTPP, now the CUSMA, is that, and I will quote our Prime Minister, it's one thing to sign and ratify free trade agreements, but it's another to implement them. And the piece of legislation is only as good, I think, as its implementation. Our particular experience with the CETA agreement has been frustrating. We've been one of the champions of the CETA since inspection. We've gone to every round of negotiations, have worked closely with the negotiators, and when the tariffs came down, a number of non-tariff barriers were to be addressed that remain to be addressed now. There were commitments in the CETA on sanitary and phytosanitary measures, cooperation on biotechnology, technical barriers to trade, and those are things that affect the trade of food products and that are even more problematic than tariffs themselves. You see now the modern free trade agreements, CETA, CPTPP, that include those elements. In the past, they used to really focus most on tariffs, but now these elements are in the trade agreements because they are at least as important as tariffs. And with the CETA, unfortunately, we are over 2 years in the agreement, and for us, it's in large part a free trade agreement that remains sitting on shelves because those non-tariff barriers that need to be addressed, that the EU is slow to move and abide by its commitment, remain outstanding. So the agreement for us is sitting on the shelves, and it's really important that leaders address those in a timely manner. So I think with respect to the CETA in particular, we know that Canada and the EU have very strong relationships, and we know that they have announced last month or back at the end of January, really important work being done on the WTO. So it's great to see those bilateral efforts and done on a bilateral basis, but on a multilateral basis as well. But it would be good to see the CETA working for our exporters as well. I think it's time.
So, I mean, maybe just for you and Vaughan to unpack that a bit more, I mean, what are maybe the top one or two specific non-tariff barriers? I think there's probably a lot of folks in the crowd that they're not in the weeds every day on this, so maybe sort of explain a little bit about some of the specific issues.
So those, as you can understand, are very technical, and they include the mutual recognition of meat processing systems, the recognition of livestock practices, the timely approval of biotechnology traits and crop input products, and as well as ensuring that country of origin labeling in Italy does not affect, is not applied in a trade restrictive manner. Wheat exports to Italy used to be our top exports. The Italians have been buying our pasta for the past 100 years to make our wheat to make their pasta, and our exports as a result, as a direct result of country of origin labeling in Italy, have dropped by over 60%. So it's really nonsense. It doesn't go in the spirit of the CETA, and this really should be addressed.
Vaughan, do you have anything else you want to add to that?
What I would just reflect upon is I think that there was some fear when CETA was getting negotiated that Canada was going to come to Europe and just dump all of this agriculture products into their marketplace. And I think that, you know, with the implementation, although it's certainly not reaching its full potential yet, I think that we can clearly say that's not going to happen and that trade is going to go both ways. They are selling products to us. And so hopefully we can continue to have that dialogue about how to continue to build our trade relationship, but then also carry that those lessons learned into our negotiations that are forthcoming with the UK.
Great. So, Ted, I mean, you've seen it from the business side when you were at Maple Leaf. I mean, you know, when you're actually in the corporate head office thinking about trade agreements, you know, what's the view on how they're working and what they need to do to work better?
We always hope they're going to work better than what you read in the paper. They rarely do because of exactly what both the ladies have been saying. It's a business that consumers have a lot to say about the product, and they tend to side with their local farmers on every issue. So there's always going to be that tension. I see the three big trade agreements as most importantly as putting a floor under the, you know, what we can expect on the protectionism side. That's the first thing, and bringing a little bit of predictability and sustainability to the business system. But it is true that the technical barriers to trade in these agreements are challenging, to say the least. And in the EU, I think we underestimate the Volkswagen syndrome in general. And that's just something that plagues the negotiators. There's a lot of cosmetics and a lot of people that will say one thing and ultimately find a way or loophole to not do it. And that's not just the EU. It's many of the people we have to deal with. You know, we often talk about ourselves being a little bit Boy Scoutish, but the reality is we generally live up to our word on agreements, and that can't be honestly said about all other countries. What I do take from this, though, from what you've heard, is that beyond putting a floor on so under this protectionism, I think we really do need a plan B. We must go ahead with the negotiations and push hard with them. But what I was hoping to hear more of today, and I don't think we hear much of from government or from business. In fact, business is good at their own strategies, but not when we talk about this kind of thing. What is the strategy? Several people came to that. Goldie came to, you know, alluded to it this morning, and others on the other panels alluded to it. But, you know, we tend to be very good at tactics, and negotiators, we have the best in the world, but they're very sharp negotiators. They can do great agreements. A lot of that's tactics. And then we talk about policy, but we don't talk about strategy. And there's a reordering problem here, because first you have a strategy. Then out of that comes a policy, and out of the policy comes tactics. I think we're working the other way around. And so I would just say at some point in time, we need people to get together and talk about what is a strategy. And I think you would get a very different conversation in how we would approach this. And trade negotiations would be one part of that.
So, I mean, one place where we're particularly having difficulty figuring out what the strategy, the tactics, and the policy are at times is China. We've heard a lot, be that today or in other conferences, about the importance of China for Canadian agriculture and agri-food producers. But, you know, it's a uncertain and, you know, bit of a mess at the moment. So maybe, Claire, I'll start with you. I mean, what are you sort of hearing from your members on what it is that we need to do moving ahead to help the agri-food sector specifically?
In China in particular, Canada must pursue long-term positive and solid relationships. It will take probably some time, but we need to get to a stage where we have stable access to our second largest export market and one that will be the first importer of ag products in the world in 5 years from now. So it's our expectation that in China, but around the world as well, officials continue to engage in a way that enables prosperity. And for us, that means enabling trade and making sure that, again, We have a trade that is based on rules, on science, stable and predictable. That work needs to be done with China, but I think around the world as well, if you look at the current global context and the discussions, the WTO, the lack of adherence for certain rules around the world, foreign governments blatantly not respecting trade rules, even in here in North America, there needs to be a lot of work done in that area with China, but not only. And with that, we need Plan B, and part of it is to continue our diversification efforts. We are now finally making inroads in Asia, thanks to the CPTPP. Our exports are growing, in particular in Japan. We're still having issues in Vietnam on the great grain side. But we need to do more of that. And perhaps the CPTPP platform is one way to start. Perhaps we could be inviting other countries, Thailand, Indonesia, even South Korea, we already have a free trade agreement, but perhaps we can get better terms of access to the South Korean market and reinforce the trading platform in that side of the world. Perhaps we should be launching FTA discussions with the ASEAN region, which we've been in exploratory discussions for some time now. So we need to look at this. We've heard about the UK as well. So we need to put all of these Plan B and C in action now.
Vaughn, China, what are your members telling you?
We had a complicated year with China. We were the market was closed to us in June. Before that, our exports into China were up 400%. It was looking to be quite a promising year in that market. I will reflect that 10 years ago, we weren't doing any beef trade with China, and so it's an interesting market in terms of course, how quickly things can change. And without a doubt, the conversation is convoluted. But perhaps what I would say is I do think that agriculture is a good place to have that conversation, to move the Canada-China relationship in the right direction. I'm very excited that Ambassador Barton is there, somebody who knows a lot about Canadian agriculture and the food needs of China. I'm sure many of you heard that China has been struggling with African swine fever, which really decimated a huge portion of their food. And so I think that there's an opportunity for Canada and China to have exchanges on technology and agriculture, to have exchanges on how to advance innovation. And they've been very clear that they want to be self-sufficient. And there's a lot of similarities, I would say, between perhaps the landscape that we have to work with. So perhaps agriculture can be a platform for which we continue to advance that relationship.
Ted, I mean, you have a bit of experience dealing with China when you were in your previous life at Maple Leaf. I mean, what's your experience been in terms of, how you can sort of parlay that into where it is that we need to go with the relationship?
Well, for starters, you have to develop leverage. If you don't have leverage, you don't have a relationship. And so I would encourage us to think again back to the strategy side. And maybe, just as a curiosity, how many understand why our meat got back into China? Just raise your hand. A few do. Okay. Well, that's good. So let's challenge that understanding slightly and just see if it's the same one. As Fawn said, when you have half your pigs in your country die, you have a food problem. And a food problem is extremely important to the Chinese leadership. So if we play to the food security issue, and it was just mentioned that Chinese want to see, Chinese see food security as self-sufficiency. But self-sufficiency, and you can find this talking to Chinese unofficially that know this game well, they know they cannot be self-sufficient in growing food to support their own population in China. They know that's a fact of life. It's not a stretch. They only have half the arable land required to grow that food. So they have to come up with a different version of self-sufficiency if they're going to feed themselves. It's not going to be that, because self-sufficiency on feeding yourself only in China is the big problem is the sustainability of that. And they've already proven that that sustainability is not there. So you get all kinds of problems, including zoonotic disease, which not the one we're experiencing today, but many others, and swine fever, etc. So how do you tackle that? Well, first off, you develop, it was said earlier today, great relationships and networks in China where you can talk to your customers, you can talk to officials, and you probably are going to talk to the political side as well, although they may not listen, but you can talk to them. And you have to have a consistent story. Well, that's the consistent story because it's factual that I just gave you. But in the meat one, we did something else. We actually knew where the problem was originating from in part of the Chinese bureaucracy. So we wanted to develop a bit of education for both ourselves, interestingly enough, and for the Chinese. That, you know, if you're going to largely depend on your imports of pork from Europe, then you may want to have a closer look at Europe, because what's the first thing you find out? Well, they per capita eat more pork than you do. That was a big shock to the Chinese, that somebody actually ate more pork than they did, you know, over 30 kilos per person. And so that your largest supplier is coming from that, they're only 11% net exporter of pork. So once you get beyond the 11%, what are you doing if you're a Chinese buyer buying more pork from Europe? So you're buying pork from the UK, which is a million tons short of pork to start with. What does that do? Well, it drives inflation very quickly, and we saw that. So when you're a Canadian and you've just been cut off from meat and you want to make the point to them that, now just let me understand what you're doing here. You're taking out Canada, which we're 70% exporter of pork, but 45% net exporter. So you're cutting us off so you can buy more pork from somebody who's going to have to backfill and import. How does that work? And you know what? It gave the importers and it gave a lot of the officials who didn't want to see us kicked out in the first place a reason to push back and say, hey, wait a minute. What are we doing to our food security issue? And that became a major talking point in the discussion at the right time. So what I want to leave you with is that thought. It is important to develop leverage. It's important to understand the business deeply enough that you can do that. And if you can, you can bring the subject back to sustainability again, because that is the Achilles heel. And their idea of self-sufficiency today is not one that we would be too interested in, except we'll get maybe come back at it again. They see South America as their backyard. So recolonizing South America is the solution to self-sufficiency if you own that product. That's our fault, because we look at the great supplier of food to the world, we look at each other as competitors. That's crazy. We should be looking at each other as alliance partners and how to do that.
Thanks. So we have time for one more question. And Ted sort of opened up the discussion path around strategy. We've been talking a lot about tactics and policies thus far. So maybe Ted, I'll kind of ask you first. You know, if Minister Bibeau were to come to you and say, you know, what does the strategy look like and how do we get there? What would you say to her? Mm-hmm.
Well, I'll start with the first point I just left off. I would find a coalition of the willing. One of the most interesting things is that almost every category of staple foods you can think of is essentially dominated by about five players, five countries. Well, let's start with the big picture first. Does everybody understand that of the top five exporters of food in the world, four on that list are also on the top five importers? And Canada's on both lists. So that may come as a shock to everybody, because the first one, I'm using the EU as one, okay? So the EU is the largest exporter of food. US is number two, China's number three, Brazil number four, Canada number five. And you go through the import side, it's the same guys, only you take Brazil out and put Japan in the same place. And so it's a very tight club. You don't have to convince the entire world. You got a very tight club to play with to start it. So that's your first strategic issue. And the second one, I think clearly, is that we need, as a country, we need to be more focused on collecting up those key alliance players. If you're, you know, if you're in the meat game, you know who they are. There's one of them in the room. So if you're in the grain game, you know who they are. And usually it's the Americas that are the key, along with Oceania. So that's number two. And then the third piece that's extremely important, I said at the beginning, we need to really realize that we have to add more value to these products, because that's where the world is moving. There's less politics involved. And the most interesting thing is our trade negotiators have done a fabulous job on the sections of the trade negotiations where you're adding value. Less so on the commodity side. Great work on the value, on the side of more processed products, where we've really seriously reduced tariffs, and yet we aren't able to play in that game. So those would be three key components of a strategy. Is I think some trade-offs with raw material versus value added.
Vaughn, what do you think?
Yeah, so I think the one thing that we have to get our heads wrapped around and have good conversations about is on climate change and sustainability in the Canadian context. And you know, the example that I'm going to give on this is how many people know about the beef industry in Brazil and its relationship to Brazilian rainforests? Like everybody, right? You read about it all the time in the media. Well, how many people know about the beef industry in Canada and its complete reliance on a native ecosystem, that the only reason that that ecosystem is left is because of beef producers? You know, the Northern Great Plains, there's less than 20% left. You go into Manitoba, if you want to have a really good cry, you know, go stand in a tall grass prairie that's 6 foot tall and know that there's less, like there's around 2 or 3% of that left. And so I don't think that Canadians know that. And I don't think that they know that about beef. I don't think that they know it about canola. I don't think that they know it. And so I think that if we need to, you know, in future trade agreements, be talking about climate change and about what Canada can contribute and what we should be doing in different specific areas and how our farmers are going to be able to adapt to what climate change is bringing, you know, I think I would be having a strategy on communicating, on policy, on all the different fronts on climate change. And it's something that I think we should all be really proud of where we are in Canada, but that is no reason to sit on our laurels, and we better get chugging along on figuring out how we're going to address this as a global economy.
Claire?
I think we need to do work at home here on making sure that the agreements that we have ratified are implemented properly, and that there is work done on the enforcement side. But very much to Ted's point, I think a lot of the work that we need to do as well, and that Canada is doing, is internationally at the WTO and through the international setting bodies like the OIE and so forth, that really set the rules for trade and agri-food. And the more alignment within these organizations, the more harmonization we're going to see, hopefully, around the world. And ultimately, the objective is to make sure that our farmers, our producers, our food manufacturers have less of those non-tariff barriers that are very problematic for them. Every day, every week, the list of countries that we have non-tariff barriers keeps growing. So working at home on implementation, but building leverage, perhaps, with international alliances.
Well, I probably won't be invited back if I don't spend my last 30 seconds asking what book you're reading. Like others have said, I am also stuck reading kids' books most of the days that I'm go home. So I could probably rhyme off all of the Dr. Seuss classics by now in a separate panel discussion. But Claire, what are you reading?
Same thing with kids under two. I'm stuck with kids' books these days. So
any one in particular right now?
No,
not the one to admit to, at least.
No, I know I should.
Vaughn?
I have a labor of love right now. I'm trying to understand my husband. He's
this is getting really candid. I think we should keep going for another 10 minutes.
He's a long distance runner, and I don't get it. So I'm reading The Rise of the Ultra Runners through, you know, my passion of reading to try and understand his passion of running. There we go.
Ted, last word to you.
Besides reading my grandchildren kids' books too, I've just finished The Levelers, Levelers. It's a great, great book about the mess we're in today.
Right. Well, thanks very much, everyone, for all those insights. And I think people are off to a break now, if I'm not mistaken.
That is true. Please join me in thanking Mark and the panel for... Thanks for listening to this episode of The Global Exchange. Today, we listened to a panel from our third annual Canada State of Trade Conference. If you like the show, remember to give us a rating on your podcast app. You can also find the Canadian Global Affairs Institute on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. The Global Exchange is brought to you by our team at CJAI. Thanks go out to producer Jay Rankin and to True Phillips for providing our music. I'm Colin Robertson. Thanks for joining us today on The Global Exchange.